with death on the air. We're here cause we care. We ask no more questions that others don't dare. We're dead on the air. We're back, we're dead on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning, everybody. Believe it or not, Dad's on the air this morning is coming from sunny Queensland. At least it's sunny now. It hasn't been for the last few days. We've had over 1 month's rain in an overnight session. So lots of boats are floating down the river, having let go of their moorings. And it's quite a funny sight, but I'm sure the owners aren't too impressed. This morning we've got a change. As I said, I'm Sue Price. I'm from Men's Rights Agency up here in Queensland, though we are a national organisation, and I think I'm pretty well known to Dads on the Air listeners. But there have been some changes in the volunteers in who are operating Dads on the Air. Most of you will have realised that it is a volunteer organisation, and they have all done an absolutely magnificent job over the 10 years that Dads on the Air has been on the air. It was started by Uncle Buck and with Peter Vandervoort's help and a well-known journalist, John Stapleton, who was very, very impressive in the way he handled the issues of bringing interviews to the people. Today, Dads on the Air is still maintained after its 10-year record-breaking airtime, brings you cutting-edge information related to fathers, family law, shared parenting, domestic violence studies, dads and children, interviews with authors, researchers, opinion writers from around the world. And the program has kept Australian dads and their supporters, which include many mothers, sisters, new partners, up to date with government proposals, new findings and all items of interest to fathers and their children, whether they're separated or in intact families. Today, the presenters are Ian Purdy, who's on air with us today. Good morning, Ian.
Good morning, Sue. I am indeed.
He's the man behind putting the program to air. Without Ian, we would be absolutely lost.
Well, thank you. It's very nice of you to say that.
And Bill Cable, who unfortunately is not able to be here today. He's a registered family relationship mediator, and his lovely partner, Catherine, who helps behind the scenes as well. Phil York from Dads in Distress is usually here.
Yes, he is, but not this morning. That's right.
Peter Vandervoort is still around, but he also can't be here today. And Greg Andreessen, who's given the value of his analytical mind to question and challenge much of the information used to wrongly educate the public about domestic violence in the community. Greg now has other projects on the go to further alert the community to the real statistics of family abuse, and he has been the prime motivator and designer behind a new website, which is, you might want to get your pens out for this one, www.oneinthree.com.au, and it contains a powerful collection of studies exploding the myths and realities and contributions of experts from around the world to dispel the notion that only men are violent and only women are victims. The title of the site is One in Three Victims of Domestic Violence Are Male. So, but today, we've got an unusual position. As I said, that all the people are away, apart from Ian and myself. I've been roped in, press-ganged into bringing the program to you, so I hope you'll bear with us and give us some leeway as we muddle our way through this. I'm going to be joined today by Tony Smith. He's a senior barrister of considerable recognition and ability. Tony is an expert in domestic violence cases, family law, and particularly difficult situations where alienation of children is occurring or false allegations are raised. So hopefully we'll be able to gain some insight from Tony as to what's the best thing to do when facing family court. And time permitting, I thought it might be interesting to ask a young man his views and those of his friends about their attitudes to dating, future relationships, and how they see the prospects for having a family, and dare we say, living happily ever after in an intact family. But look, first of all, I've really got an extremely important duty to do, and it's with a great pleasure that I want to express our sincere thanks and admiration to John Stapleton for his dedication to Dads on the Air over the past 10 years. John, as I said previously, has planned programs, arranged interviews, conducted the interviews, written the online blurb promoting the program, and I think everyone associated with the program and our listeners would like to thank John, wish him well as he takes a well-earned break. He's off to Cambodia, flying out this morning, would you believe it? Thailand and perhaps Vietnam. Hopefully he'll find time to send us a postcard or phone in a contribution or two to the program. Thank you, John, from the bottom of our hearts for your dedication to the cause of promoting the importance of fathers in their children's lives. Future generations will, I am sure, have much to thank you for, as Dads on the Air is recognised as a world-class contributor to the discussion about the importance of fathers and being involved in their children's lives.
Hear, hear. Very well said, Sue. I totally support those sentiments. And, yeah, everybody, I think everybody, all the crew from Dads on the Air, definitely wishes John well in his new future, basically.
We hope we'll see him back with renewed vigour and renewed intention to promote the cause that we're all so passionate about. Do you think we might take a short break, Ian? And... Or
certainly.
Is that too early for you?
No, we'll just take a short break. This is a Holly's track. He Ain't Heavy, He's My Brother. Thank you, Sue. We'll be back in a moment.
Yeah.
The road is long. So long, long road. From which there is no return. While we're on the way to live, why not share?
we're back with Dads on the Air.
And we're back. Sue.
Once again, I want to talk about the inquiries that are going on that were commissioned by the Attorney General, and we've got 6 inquiries in total, and we have the results of 2 inquiries were released about 10 days or so ago. In the latter half of 2009, he wanted to inquire into Family Court's violence review that has been conducted by an ex-Family Court judge, Richard Chisholm, who was not noted for his tolerance of fathers and has been known to jail them for minor transgressions without much hesitation. Professor Chisholm certainly was not a supporter of shared parenting, and his report is out. We'll discuss that shortly. The Australian Institute of Family Studies, its second report to be released, they've conducted a monitoring role to report on the effects of the 2006 changes after, and I was asked by the Attorney General to provide a submission to the Australian Institute of Family Studies, but I was informed by Laura Maloney they were not interested in speaking to groups such as MRA, that's Men's Rights Agency, and would only consult with the designated and approved groups included in the inquiry specifications. That report has been released, and we'll come back to that as well. Yet another report was a family violence research project run by Professor Thea Brown. This is a researcher who gave us the information that only 9% of allegations were false, based on information that only 9% of the women she interviewed were prepared to admit they had made false allegations.
Well, that's very credible, isn't it?
The question always remained how many maintained the lie of false allegations during prosecution for perjury. Not that that ever seems to happen in the family court anyway.
That's right.
But the research in this situation is via an online questionnaire where the respondents are not required to identify themselves. So it has little credibility in my book, because in these days of cookie deletion, I'm sure your listeners know what they can do with cookies, they can make repeated responses to all these online surveys.
Yeah,
unless,
no,
of course, you ask for identification. The fourth report is the Shared Parental Responsibility Research Project. We don't know much about that, apart from they're using 3 sets of data to compare outcomes for children living apart with outcomes for children who are living with both parents. That's conducted by the Social Policy Research Centre of New South Wales and the Australian Institute of Family Studies. And finally, there's another inquiry and recommendation from the Australian Law Reform Commission to develop a national legal framework to tackle family violence, but only for the benefit of women and children. Well, there's nothing wrong with protecting or reducing violence against women and children, but why not include violence against men at the same time? Do they have a complete disbelief in violence by women against men and children? This is something we know is quite evident. I think you had a couple of stories in that.
Absolutely.
That women were particularly violent towards their children.
Well, there was a case, I think last week, of a woman who was acquitted for stabbing her baby. Her husband at the time was holding the child, and she attacked him with a carving knife or something and accidentally murdered the baby in his arms. And she was let off by the court. The judge said that she'd suffered enough. She was actually allowed to go home. You can sort of imagine what would have happened if it was the other way around, if a father had murdered the baby while trying to stab the mother. I mean, do you think he would have been, slapped on the wrist and said, there, dear, you've suffered enough?
Yeah, so it's absolutely unbelievable. Was that Victoria by any chance?
I think so, yes, I think it was. Yeah,
of course they have the unusual system whereby the Attorney General there, Rob Holds, has removed the defence of provocation. But allows a defence of a domestic violence, and I think 2 women a couple of years ago were allowed to walk free once they claimed domestic violence after they had deliberately killed their husbands.
Yeah, well, there was that one in South Australia, I think, where she actually dressed in fatigues and waited for her husband to come home and then put 6 bullets into him.
Yeah, that's right.
And she was allowed to go home to the children because they'd had an argument the night before over the potato drawer or something ridiculous.
Yeah. It really is. It's turning the law on its head, isn't it, when those things happen?
Well, it is indeed.
I just want to take a break. I just want to interrupt briefly. I want to introduce Tony Smith to you. He's just joined us here. He's found his way to our place. Welcome, Tony.
Good morning.
Tony is a barrister, senior barrister of some note. He specialises in family law issues, particularly difficult situations where there may be false allegations or alienation. He's had a lot of success in that area. He does a lot with criminal law and also domestic violence issues. So he's a fund of information for us, and it's really great that he could join us this morning. He came back from Sydney yesterday and said, yes, I'll definitely be on board, which I really do welcome, because being a first timer at this is a bit nerve-wracking on your own.
A bit daunting, yes indeed.
Anyway, what do you think, Tony, about those couple of comments about the way the law's being turned upside down?
It seems to be applying a separate standard for based on sex. I mean, I don't say that in the sense of that's a definite, but it seems to be moving in that direction, and unfortunately that's a very bad thing. The law, of course, must apply itself equally, irrespective of sex. The law has got to be even-handed, and I think the comments that were made about the issue with that tragedy involving the baby are quite apposite here, because it would be, I would have thought, very unlikely that the general attitude that is taken towards incidents like that, if they are done by a male, seems to be different. It just seems to be different. There seems to be a greater level of forgiveness, if you like, at one level, and perhaps just sheer bias at another. In cases, I don't know the full story of that case, of course, so I wouldn't want to go beyond just a general perception. But look, generally speaking, there is, I think there's been, since the 2006 changes to the Family Law Act, certainly, and I know I'm moving away a little bit from that, there has been a greater recognition of fathers and in the lives of their children. That's been a good thing. And, of course, now we're seeing a purported movement away from that, which I think is not a good thing, because, again, it's destabilising a system that is only really starting to bed in. It hasn't had, by any means, sufficient time to really bed in. So that's another issue that I think, again, where the agenda is being driven on the basis, I think primarily, that that men perhaps have got a little bit too much out of those changes.
I think that presumption that they've jumped the gun a little bit on it, and they haven't allowed the changes, the 2006 changes to family law, to properly be established. We've only had a change, according to the Australian Institute of Family Studies report, we only have 16% of children now in shared care, and that can be anything from 35% upwards. So it's not been a huge change. I think it moved from about 9%, Ian, up to 16%.
We've got the figures here. It says in 1997, 3% of children whose parents had separated were in a shared care arrangement. In 2006, 12% of children were living in an equal shared care arrangement. And in 2010, 16% of children are living in an equal shared arrangement. So that's really only up 4% since 2006, since the reforms were instigated.
So maybe what we should be saying is, what are we going to do to improve the Family Law Act to increase that role of fathers in their children's lives?
Because, well, you'd think that would be a more sensible approach, but apparently they're attempting to go the other way.
Well, yeah, something the Attorney General said when he released these reports, the Australian Institute of Family Studies report and the Richard Chisholm report into family violence, has said... this is quoted here, the Attorney General has already responded to reports by repeating the claim that the equal shared parental responsibility presumption has given rise to an allegedly false understanding that parents are entitled to equal time in caring for the child, Mr. McClellan said. And then he goes on, regrettably, there have been instances where people have resolved cases, settled cases, on the assumption that the law intends an equal split of time. Perhaps I can ask Tony, as being a legal expert of this, but it's not as I read it.
No. Look, that whole process that was mandated by the 2006 amendments is not a lay-down misere for equal time at all. Indeed, there are a lot of hoops to jump through before you get to that position. There are so many checks and balances, as was said only very recently by Justice Warnick in a decision on interim parenting, where he allowed an appeal by a father against a magistrate's order that would have seen him having less time on an interim basis. There is this cascading effect of the legislation. So if you have the presumption that if the presumption applies, you then move through the various stages. And that includes, first of all, the issue of whether there should be equal time. That's a question. And then if that's not in the best interest, substantial and significant time. And so you're moving through all these various things. And so for equal time to apply, there's got to be an awful lot going for the parents for that to apply. And usually, as Sue is quite right in saying, usually that means the father, who may be seeking equal time, has got to jump through quite a few hoops to get there. And apart from anything else, even if he manages to jump through those hoops, there may well be issues of such disputation between the parties that parenting on a shared basis just wouldn't work anyway. So the court might ultimately conclude, well, look, everything else is right, but in the circumstances of this case, people just don't get on sufficiently to satisfy the best interest principle. Now, I must say that, and I find it disturbing a little, actually, that there are cases that come to court where a party, usually who has the children on a primary basis, will manufacture disputation in order to promote this notion, well, they could never co-parent.
That was going to be my next question, Tony. Do you think the court needs to take more account of the person who is actually causing the conflict?
Absolutely. I mean, the court has got to pay more than mere lip service to the notion, it's not a notion, it's a legislative proscription, where allegations are made that are false, or a case is run on a completely false premise, be it serious allegations of sexual impropriety against children, or serious allegations of domestic violence, which is just a basis where there's no basis for it. And in the Act, there was provision for where those allegations have been made, where they've had to be defended, that the costs should be paid by the person making the allegations. Now, I understand from the proposals I'm hearing,
Richard Chisholm.
Yes,
yep.
That they don't like that. They don't like that. That is supposedly, and with the greatest respect to Richard Chisholm, he is suggesting that somehow or other that prevents women from making claims that violence have been made. That's just preposterous. If you are telling the truth, you are not prevented from making claims. If you have some doubts about it, then you might be questioning whether you should be making the claims.
Tony, I made the point with the Attorney General when we met with him last year that I very much doubted that anyone who thought their children were at risk would have been put off by a threat of a cost order against them if the protection of their children was first and foremost in their mind. I found it quite unbelievable that could be suggested.
Well, I think it is it's a dubious suggestion, and B, it ignores the original basis for putting in those particular provisions. Those provisions were not put in because someone or other felt that they should give men a free kick or something. They were put in because it was felt that these claims were being made on a regular basis. And I must say, from personal experience, you see it very regularly. You see outrageous claims being made, and you see consistently similar claims being made, and ultimately, when tested or just before trial, they're abandoned. Particularly when the family reports are done, and a good family report writer and or forensic psychologist or psychiatrist has investigated the matter properly. Frequently, we see these claims just vanish. So I think at the end of the day, Sue, I think by this move, I see it more as a political move, and with all respect to those who have undertaken these reports, including the former judge Richard Chisholm, I do see that there is some motivation here to change the political sort of dynamic, or to introduce rather a political dynamic into what should be really, hey, let's get back to what is in the best interests of children, and that is to have the maximum possible time with both parents.
That's well said, Tony, and I think that would be every listener's point of view. And look, Ian, we might take another quick break, do you think?
Absolutely, sounds like a good idea. We'll be back after this particular track. Thank you, Sue.
Okay, fine.
In my bed no more. You can't ride in my car. I won't let you get for me, baby. It's never gonna get that far. I'm gonna send you back to where grandfather hell it was you came. And then I'm gonna get this tattoo changed to another girl's name. Oh, it ain't no fun no more. I don't know what you say. Your honeymoon is over, baby. It's never gonna be that way. Come on. Yeah. Well, you can't borrow my shirts no more. You can't make a love to me. I hope don't be your thing no more. It's the way it's gonna be. I should've left you, baby, back in that last time. Cause the kind of fool you made me, girl, I'll never live it down. What you say? Your honeymoon is over, baby. It's never gonna be that way. Yeah. Ride in my car. I won't let you cook for me, baby. It's never gonna get that far. I'm gonna send you back to where the hell it was you came. And then I'm gonna get this tattoo change to another girl's name. Oh, it ain't no fun no more. I don't know what to say. Your honeymoon is over, baby. It's never gonna be that way.
They grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you were ever there anyway.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1-300-853-437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
Perhaps, Ian, we can talk a little bit more about the Professor Chisholm report, which was into family violence and family law and the interaction between the two.
Absolutely.
He's come up with suggestions that there's a de facto presumption of the 80-20 outcome, that really he's trying to put us back into that zone by removing situations where we've got equal and shared care notions to the fore. Richard Egan, who writes for Family Voice, said Professor Chisholm's proposal to deprive the court of any guidance favouring equal shared parental responsibility would, if implemented, most likely result in a return to the old de facto 80-20 standard. And that was something that the Cahill report was very, very certain that they wanted to avoid, that they wanted to move away from this 80-20 position.
Well, absolutely. We had that for years, and that was the problem. That clearly didn't work.
Yeah, they're saying, Richard Egan is saying, that the backward step would only increase the incidence of practical fatherlessness already being experienced by too many Australian children. The Australian Institute of Family Studies reports that of those children whose parents separated between July 2006, that's when the changes came into being, and September 2008, 1 in 3 never stay overnight with their father, and 1 in 9 never see their father at all. It would seem to me that we need to do a lot more to promote the notion of shared parenting than we're already doing.
Absolutely. The rights of the children to see their father, basically, or to see both their parents.
Well, that's right. He's recommending we replacing the presumption that both mum and dad have equal shared parental responsibility with a sort of parental responsibility test in which the court would rate mums and dads on how they've performed so far as parents and what capacity and willingness they have to parent well. I'm sure Tony has a few thoughts on this.
Well, I do. I think there's almost an over effort to try to regulate the exercise of the judicial discretion here. I mean, it was very important to get fundamentals in place, and the parental responsibility presumption of equal shared parental responsibility, that was a key aspect of the 2006 change. Now, there obviously have been some concerns about how it's being applied to particular cases, and the courts have wrestled a bit with this, and there are a number of cases that have effectively evolved the way in which the courts deal with it. But it's almost like, you know, the government or the political side is saying, well, look, you're not doing this the way we would like it, so we're going to have to impose another stricture upon you so that you'll do it the way we want you to do it. And I don't think, I'm just speaking here now from a very perhaps legalistic, a lawyer's point of view, but it's not a good thing to be doing that. The court, many, many years of experience of the evolution of the common law means that courts, little by little, do adapt by case by case by case. They do need guidelines, and I think the 2006 amendments were important. I mean, many people, perhaps at the time, particularly a number of fathers, thought they didn't go far enough, and there was obviously some concern about it. But ultimately, the court has had, as I say, about 3 years to start evolving a body of jurisprudence based on case law and fact situations to apply this act. Now, from a distance, the courts are being told, well, look, we're going to have to give you further instruction on how to do this because you don't know how to do it properly, and we want you to narrow it down, and so on and so forth. So I just think it is wrong. I think these reforms need to be left as they are for at least 10 years. to allow a period of time to see how they go.
That would seem to be a much more sensible attitude to take, wouldn't it, Dan?
Yeah, well, definitely. I mean, rather than just charge on, and they've only been enforced, what, 3 years or something, and we are starting to see a slight improvement, but the figures show that this presumption of equal shared parenting is a myth. I mean, the figures are increasing by 1% per year, 1% more, you know, which is...
It's a very small increase, so maybe, as I said, we need to look at further positive changes that are going to encourage more shared parenting. But the Australian Institute of Family Studies report showed that 81% of parents with children under 18 agreed that the continuing involvement of each parent following parental separation is beneficial for the children. And I think it was 70% of parents who are actually in shared care thought it was working well. So we have one report on one side saying, you know, good things are coming out of shared parenting, and yet Richard Chisholm's report is extremely negative and trying to roll back the position of fathers in shared parenting, and also to roll back the preventative measures to stop false allegations being made.
Yeah, you can...
I was going to also make a comment here along the lines that... I've just made in. I know we've spoke about the 2006 amendments, but I just recalled a case that was decided by Justice Lepore Trench some years ago. It was probably around 2001. I better not mention the name in case it's the actual name. I'm not sure that the pseudonym was used, so I can't mention the name of the case. But in that case, His Honour analysed equal shared parenting in great and voluminous detail, and after he did all of that, and I must say in that particular case there was quite a bit of disputation by both parties. Some of it I recall His Honour saying was perhaps more confected by one or other party than realistically was the case. But His Honour took the view that at the end of the day, it was the regime of equal shared parenting for these children, I think there are two children involved, would ultimately bed in and work out, because the problems that were coming between the parties were caused by this constant tension about time. So once the time was shared, it took the tension out. It relieved the children of having to bear the parents' tension over those matters. And he felt that on making the orders, he felt that the tension would eventually evaporate. Now, I don't know whether that has happened, but I thought it was a very positive way to view it.
I think we still have some judges that are pro-shared parenting and some who are not, unfortunately.
Yes. Yes.
And some don't see the value of fathers in their children's lives and seem to take an over-sympathetic view, perhaps, of a mother and child situation, which comes back, of course, again to the primary attachment theories and, you know, mother and child first, mother and child belong together, but whereas not... those findings have been debunked many times since they were first made in 1951. But I think one thing I was just picked up out of one of my old files was I wonder why the Labor Party are pushing so hard to have these changes made. I can only believe that it's the people that they have in the ministries, the Tanya Plibersek's and people like that who have been raised on a diet of domestic violence and can't see beyond that to looking at the very many parents who are good parents. More than 95% of them don't go anywhere near the family court, but of course their agreements are made under the shadow of the law. But Wayne Swan said, he was interviewed on the on the radio in 2003, before they got into government, of course, and they said a journalist asked, can or should the government regulate parenting arrangements? And he said, no, they can't. All governments can do is try to ensure that regulations and laws bring families closer together. You see, what we really need is some urgent action from this government to assist families to stay together in the first place. It is getting increasingly harder for parents to be good parents and good workers. That is why we need some constructive proposals to ensure that families spend more time with their kids. That requires reform in the industrial relations system. We need a fair family payment system to take the financial pressure off families. We need a whole range of initiatives that encourage parents to stay together, not necessarily putting band-aids on at the end. And he says, to begin with, the journalist also asked him, what do you think of the idea of joint child custody? While I don't think one size suits all, I think our objective must be to ensure the parents, particularly dads, spend more time with their kids. So let's have some constructive action. There has been report after report. This is the funny part, considering what's happened since. This is written or taped before the 2006 changes. And he says there has been report after report. Let's get some positive, constructive proposals which ensure that kids in the end are better off.
Well, we hear that again and again, don't we? There it is.
We have six inquiries underway at the moment, all of them trying to devalue the role of fathers in their children's lives.
Perhaps should read that quote back to Mr. Swan.
Yeah, I do intend to send it to him, and I hope all your listeners will use it. We'll put it up on the net.
His tune certainly has changed since he's been in government, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, that's right. I thought that was a gem when I found it. I thought I'd have to use it somewhere.
No, that's amazing that Wayne Swan actually said all of that before he became the Treasurer.
That's right. Before he was in government. And obviously has a role. But I believe that rumour has it that Kevin Rudd is quite distressed by the focus that's been given to the shared parenting rollback, as we've been calling it. And he has, I believe, asked Rob McClellan to almost bury it until after the next election.
They're certainly
not going to make it an issue for this election.
I think
we have to make it an issue, because we have to have a guarantee before the next election that they're not going to roll back shared parenting, and they are actually going to improve the shared parenting for both fathers and mothers.
Well, but obviously shows that the noise we are making is getting through, because if they're not prepared to look at this issue in an election year, then they realise that it's going to lose them votes. So that is a positive from our side. But I do agree it would be good to have a guarantee before the election that they're not going to basically wash these paltry reforms of John Howard down the drain.
Look, not just good, it's absolutely essential, so we have to keep the pressure on to make sure that the government understands that fathers are not going to be relegated to a second class citizen role in their children's lives. They are primary importance to their children. We know that. The research tells us that. Why do we have a government that is so intent on removing them?
You know, Sue, I often think about something I heard some years ago. I was listening to a psychologist speaking about the number of young men who have come to him over the years in the course of his work and say, can you please explain to me how I can be a dad, because they've never had a dad, and how tragic that is, that we are seeing a whole busload of boys without fathers.
And with no knowledge of what it is to be
a parent
or to be a father.
Yeah.
Look, there are programs now in the UK and in America which are in trying to teach young men how to be fathers and how to be involved with their children. We shouldn't have to be doing that. If they had a dad in their life in the first place, they would learn how to be a good dad. But obviously, they're reaping the rewards of whatever it is, this unbelievable anti-father brigade that keeps sort of calling for get fathers out of children's lives, unnecessarily so. But, there are lots of people who are starting to write about this, which is really good news. We had a wonderful article written by Angela Shanahan, who's a mum, I think, of almost a football team. And she wrote that misconceptions that are depriving children of their fathers. we had quite a long conversations about this article and about what she thought about it and what we thought about it. She says that shared parenting by separated couples is not a perfect solution. Well, nothing is after divorce. No divorce would be a better solution, but that's no reason to scrap it. And she relates to the second story. She refers to Tony Abbott's interview with the Woman's Weekly and the way he expressed his right to have an opinion about his moral education of his own
children. Wasn't that bizarre?
As if he didn't have a right to express any opinion at all. But then she referred to the second story, she says, has a similar thread running through it with much graver implications. It concerns shared parenting by separated or divorced couples, which was the basis for family law reforms in 2006. According to some commentators, it is a failed experiment. The reaction is puzzling since it goes against a supposed feminist notion of equality that fathers and mothers have equal responsibilities and roles in their children's upbringing. This story has been building for almost a year, and depending on what you read, shared parenting is, according to this newspaper, on the way out or about to be rolled back or brings little change. According to the Sydney Morning Herald, shared care failed children. Adding fuel to this is a report by Richard Chisholm and psychologist Jennifer McIntosh that concludes the reforms of 2006 have not benefited children, especially in acrimonious situations, which one might have thought was obvious. Since only 16% of parents practice shared parenting, and according to the Australian Institute of Family Studies, most arrangements work well, one wonders what Chisholm is talking about. To work well, they must be non-acrimonious. But there is more. According to Chisholm, many parents read mothers, who are still the main carers of children post-separation, are being coerced into shared parenting arrangements by fear and by a presumption on the part of the father that shared parenting equals 50-50 shared time. According to Chisholm, an unacceptable number of children in court-mandated shared care are exposed to unnecessary levels of acrimony and possible violence. However, the legislation is clear that where shared care has been ordered by a court, the presumption of shared care is dependent on there being no violence. Putting a child into a possibly violent situation contradicts the law. So what is all this about, Angela asks. Tony, you can probably answer that question.
Well,
it's codswallop, if you ask me, but anyway.
Well, it seems, I must say, as Sue was reading that, I had the thought that, because I have a little bit of a background in government as well, in politics, and that is that if you set up an inquiry to, you never set it up unless you want to get the result that is your constituency's desire.
Well, that would go along with the choice of inquirer, wouldn't it, being Richard Chisholm and Thea Brown and, yeah.
And I think you know, we yet again have, well, more dallying at the edges, and, you know, almost a case of Nero fiddling while Rome continues to burn. And as you've said, Ian, with those figures, they're not dramatic increases. They're basically in line with what's been the case anyway, and thank goodness that we've got some increase and improvement, but there's so much more to be done.
Absolutely. I mean, the improvement is minuscule.
Yeah.
You know, what they're talking about, making these huge cases about something that really, you've really got to say, is not happening. I mean, and not in terms of the scale. I mean, you know, this presumption of equal shared parenting on behalf of men, I mean, that is just ridiculous that anyone would say that.
Well, this is where Angela covers this point. She says shared care and domestic violence are separate issues.
Exactly.
Children should not be exposed at any level, but there is definitely a risk of violence to children due to family breakdown. We know that because families break down when there are these problems, alcoholism and those sort of things that go on, and not simply from the father, but from the mother and other males.
Exactly.
And, of course, this is where we've been pushing this, this argument that mothers, in actual fact, are far more place their children in far more risk by their own violence against their children and the murder of their own children,
yes,
and by mothers' boyfriends and other males that they introduce into the household.
Absolutely. A child is at its safest statistically when it's with its biological father, and that is a fact.
No, we know that. Yes, that is a fact, and there's plenty of research to show that, although much of it has been hidden over the time.
Yeah.
That's where Greg has been digging, Greg Andreessen.
Yes.
The researcher has been doing some great work on exposing some of these hidden statistics.
So I think we might just go to a quick song and then we'll come back and continue this discussion afterwards.
That would be a good idea.
So we'll be back in a moment.
So fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child. Dad's in distress. 1300 853 437.
We're back with Dad's on the air.
Yeah, and I thought Tony isn't with us for that much longer. He has to leave by 10:30. And I know that we've been talking about shared parenting rollback and the issues of child abuse and family violence, and I thought we might impose on Tony to give some advice to our fathers if they are facing allegations of family violence. You know, he's very good at what he does, Tony, and he's a brilliant advocate for fathers in this regard. You think that's a good idea for us?
I think that's a great idea.
Okay, we'll pass it over to Tony, and he can give that advice for everyone.
Well, look, one of the things that I see regularly, and I see it with a great deal of distress is where fathers have been conned, as it were, into accepting AVOs and DVOs placed on them on the basis that it won't have any effect, and you're agreeing without admission, and there's no finding against you, and so forth. The problem with that notion is, as I say, I believe it's a con. It's an out-and-out con designed to, as it were, subjugate men who, against whom frequently frivolous and vexatious allegations are made. And it does have a long-term effect, because if you have one of these orders on you, whether you've agreed to it or not, and whether the circumstances arise out of merely making a couple of phone calls trying to see where your children are and when you can next see them, which can often lead to these orders being made, the consequences are there for your employment history if you want to move into any government position or a position of in a security industry, teaching, anything like that. You are asked whether you've had previous DVO or AVO orders made against you, and you have to fill in a form, and it's going to have an effect on your either on your employability or your capacity to advance in your employment. So don't my advice is, do not fall for that trick. If frequently we see this particularly in Queensland, frequently we see a breakdown situation where sometimes unpleasant things are said. But that's the end of the matter. It doesn't go on and on and on and on and on. That's the end of the matter. Then you move on into the phase of making arrangements in the courts, and then you you deal with the separated situation. One of the things I do try to advise people is to where these applications are made, is to try and reach an accord with their former wife or partner to enter into, say, something like an undertaking where both parties undertake to be of good behaviour in the Federal Magistrates Court. They file these undertakings because, as I say, frequently they're moving into litigation of one sort or another, at least orders in relation to children. They file these undertakings in consideration of these applications for domestic violence and apprehended violence orders to be discharged or to be not proceeded with. And that way there is no... there is no record, there is no finding, there is nothing, and they do what they're going to do anyway in the majority of cases, that is, be of good behaviour in the future and parent their children. So I think it's very important, as I say, fundamentally, not to think that, I can just do what the prosecutor says and agree to this without admission. It's going to have an effect. It's going to have an effect on your family law proceedings, because you might be consenting without admission, but I would lay London to a brick that the fact that you've consented to an order, or the fact that there's an order in existence, will be mentioned in the family court proceedings.
But they often don't even mention the consenting to part,
exactly,
do they, Tony?
Exactly.
It's just that you're...
An order was made.
An order was made. And there's a lot of pressure put on people to actually agree to a domestic violence order. That's the reports we hear back from a lot of the men.
Well, that's right. Enormous pressure's put in. And you've got to remember, too, that at the breakdown time, when frequently we're dealing with so much emotion and so much hurt and heartache, that is the time when I think men in particular are most vulnerable to basically agreeing to anything, because they are so shattered by what has occurred without thinking of the longer term consequences of these orders and what they might have on them. And remember, it's not just the orders. You might make an agreement to an order. The next thing, you phone up your spouse about something and you've got an agreement to an order, and next thing she goes and says he's breached the order. That's a criminal matter.
Then you're facing jail if
exactly.
It's serious enough. Yeah,
exactly. And so, you know, it's a two-step process. I mean, resisting the orders, trying to reach an accord by way of undertakings to avoid that sort of horrible litigation, but at the same time, bearing in mind that once the order is made, it's like a permanent injunction hanging over your head for the duration of the order, usually 2 years, 1 to 2 years. And it's hanging over your head, and the moment you step out of line, a complaint can be made. The complaint can be fairly ordinary complaint. It could be that you're not supposed to be within 50 metres of where the other party is, and you might happen to drive into a garage, and there's the person. Well, what do you do? Hightail it out of the garage, leaving your car.
on one respect, Tony, I remember one gentleman whose wife, he was still living in the house, and she had a DV order on him. Every time she wanted the lawn cut, she used to hold the order in front of him. That was it. He mowed the lawn without question, because otherwise he was going to be in breach of an order.
Well, I must say, my wife doesn't need an order to make me do that.
Look, Tony, thank you very much for coming along this morning. That's been really, really fantastic, very informative, and very enjoyable to have you here, and I hope we can do it again another day.
Thank you, Sue, and may I compliment Ian and the program on the work that it's doing, and keep up the good work.
Thank you, Tony. That's very nice of you to say that, and yeah, I can only echo Sue's sentiments. We hope we get you back on again soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, Ian, whilst Tony extracts himself from the place, I'll say goodbye to him and look forward to seeing him again, and we'll talk on the phone, Tony. I just found some things this morning. I thought a little bit of light relief is probably needed. Do you know that men are just happier people? And it says, your last name stays put. The garage is all yours. Chocolate is just another snack. You can never be pregnant. You can wear a white T-shirt to a water park, or you can wear no shirt at all. Car mechanics actually tell you the truth. You don't have to stop and think which way to turn a nut on a bolt, and phone conversations are over in 30 seconds flat. A 5-day holiday requires only one suitcase, and you can open all your own jars. Not like us, poor lot. You get extra credit for the slightest act of thoughtfulness. 3 pairs of shoes are more than enough. You're unable to see wrinkles in your clothes. The same hairstyle lasts for years, maybe decades. And you can do your Christmas shopping for 25 relatives on December 24 in 25 minutes. And they say, no wonder men are happier.
There you go. I'll have to agree with all of that.
Lovely.
Well, that makes me feel happier.
The thought for the day, which is I thought was absolutely magnificent, was a married man should forget his mistakes. There's no use in 2 people remembering the same thing.
Yes.
Right. Now, any more comments, Ian, about our shared parenting? I note that Angela Shanahan had a response in the paper today about from Elspeth McInnes, that well-known responder to from the National Council of Single Mothers, or she used to be.
Uh-huh. She says, what's she saying?
Shared parenting, Angela Shanahan, misconceptions that are depriving children of their fathers, rightly notes that family law states that shared parenting should not apply when there is a risk of violence. The problem is that the identification of violence and recognition of risks to children is not within the investigative jurisdiction or expertise of the family law. In a he said, she said context, shared parenting wins over child safety concerns. That's the problem that continues to result in children being placed in the care of abusing parents.
What a load of nonsense. That is assuming that all men are violent Neanderthals.
Well, that's basically her attitude, I'm afraid. Every time I see her at a conference, she always has some other claim that women are victims of violence and the children are victims of that of violence as well. And we talked about that just before, about the levels of violence perpetrated by women. Sadly, it's a fact. People don't like to acknowledge it, but, you know, sometimes the hand that rocks the cradle
can be very
abusive.
Yes, the truth is important.
Well, absolutely. It really is important. So we don't mind if the family court is going to find on the evidence who is the most violent and make decisions based on that. But unfortunately, they tend to veer towards sympathy for mum and find excuses for her violence and reasons to keep the children with the mother when they might be better off with dad. And I think I think Elspeth, again, is confusing the issue again. They're trying to confuse shared parenting with violence issues or child abuse. There are particular courts. It comes under state legislation, both domestic violence and child abuse issues, and that is where it should be. Tested. It should be discovered if it's correct, if it's happened, and a decision made. You know, a finding made by a court. We spend millions of dollars on services like DOCS and child safety here in Queensland and community services in other states. To protect the children of parents and to make sure they're okay. If they're not doing their job, perhaps we need to be looking at improving the conditions there.
Absolutely. We know they're not doing their job. We had that shocking interview last week, that guy Daniel who'd had his children removed by DOCS. But it comes back to this attitude that from aspects of the legal profession. I don't know, you know, I guess it's they're getting their bread buttered by all of these ridiculous cases and this presumption that mothers get everything. It adds to their bank balance and their bottom line. But it seems to me like it is a Victorian attitude that a father should be distant and detached, and that they seem to be encouraging this really unfashionable. It's certainly not a 21st century attitude. The 21st century fathers are wanting to be closer to their children and more hands-on. They're just really going back into the dark ages.
Things have changed, haven't they? We no longer have mums staying at home. It's necessary for both parents to work, to provide a home for themselves and for their family. You know, it's a matter of sharing, isn't it? It's a matter of sharing the care of children.
Well, it absolutely is.
You share the workload and you share the care of children as well. Otherwise, one parent is imposed on greatly to cover both roles of being a provider and a carer.
Yep. Which is not fair on the children, it's not fair on anybody. As it sort of comes back to this sort of James Bond ideal of men, that we should all sort of, you know, basically not care. We should be running around the world, you know, in sports cars and different women on our arm every night and not have children and not care about them. I mean, it just seems to me...
But I think one thing you can say about James Bond, he certainly loved his women.
Well, he certainly did, but, there's no offspring from any of it. And
there's no room for children in
this life. No, and it's just kind of... This is what's sort of being projected on men, that we should all want that sort of, you know... I don't know, easy, free kind of lifestyle, but that's not the way it is. I mean, we know for a fact that when a woman has a baby, her husband, her partner, he has biological changes that facilitate the baby coming into the world almost as much as she does. And it's just as important for men, fathers, to be at their, you know, in their children's lives.
Of course it is. Look, everything, the evidence right across the world has shown how much better children do when dads are involved with their children. And, of course, as I mentioned earlier, the UK and USA are running programs to try to encourage more fathers to come back into their children's lives and to be a part of it. And this is one thing that we notice in talking to fathers when they ring us. We ask, why did they leave the house? Oh, because she asked me to. And we then ask the question, why? Because, you know, you're equally important in your child's life. Why should you be the one to move out? If you're not the one who's unhappy with the situation, as she is, perhaps we should be looking at more mums going off and finding out what it is they're searching for before they disrupt the family totally.
Yeah, it's a funny one, that one, because I'm sort of looking at my own situation. I mean, I left the house. I mean, to me, there was no other alternative. That I always thought, well, I was going to leave her with the child. I don't know, you wouldn't sort of consider that she would leave, but I mean, you know, our son was like 2 years old or something. And
this is where expectations are changing, though, and I think our politicians need to catch up with the expectations. Is it Warren Farrell expressed it very well in one of his books, I can't remember which one, it may have been The Myth of Male Power, where he said, you know, a number of years ago women approached men or wanted men to accept that they were their equal in all facets of life,
yeah,
including the workplace, and men moved over,
yep,
and let women into their lives and into the workplace. Now I think it's the time for women to accept that men want more time with their family and want more time in the home, and now women have got to learn to share their role as well.
Well, that's fair enough. Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, on that note, let's go to another song, and we'll be back in a moment.
Okay, fine.
Okay.
I've
Dads in Distress, meeting your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437, or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
Ian, I thought it might be an interesting experiment, put it this way, to talk to one of the younger generation. I had a bloke during the week, one of our people up in Townsville, tell me that in the paper it was full of women, young women, complaining that they couldn't find a bloke around, nobody wanted to go out with them, nobody wanted to commit to a relationship.
Dear.
Which is a sad situation.
Well, it is indeed.
But we've been hearing those reports, and of course there are a lot more women than men in Australia anyway. So I'm told. Should be a men's paradise, shouldn't it? Really?
Well, you'd hope so, but from my point of view, I can't say it's exactly a men's paradise. But
we hear lots of reports of how hard it is to meet the other sex, and how do you get an introduction to them? How do you introduce yourself? But I have persuaded with great difficulty. I'm getting daggered looks already to talk to Andrew, who is 21 years old,
a specimen of the younger generation.
A younger generation, a man about town, running two jobs, doing part-time uni, has a steady girlfriend, a lovely young lady, but he has lots and lots of friends. Of course, he's mad about cars. That, I think, is his alter life. But he said he will talk to us about what he thinks, what his friends think about the future, and what they think it holds for them. So, welcome, Andrew.
Thank you very much for the welcome, and I wouldn't say it was looking with daggers. It was more a case of trepidation of what's coming.
We'll treat you gently. We won't do a Carl Sanderland on you and ask you anything embarrassing at all.
Have you got the lie detector on him?
I haven't got the lie detector on him because, of course, it might put him in a very embarrassed situation. But I'm going to ask him what his friends think when they're out looking for a girl to date. Who do they look for?
Well, it's a little bit of a difficult question. Everyone's different. I know a lot of my friends are just looking for the proverbial fling. Some are more interested in settling down, and when they do, they tend to try and look away from... steer away from some of the Barbie dolls of this world, so to speak, and some of the extreme feminists. Basically, they're looking for an average, everyday girl that's...
without pretensions?
Yes, without pretensions, without any huge past dramas that are... or baggage, to put it simply. But unfortunately, a lot of them are finding it very difficult to come across someone like that. I've noticed it in my friends as more and more bi and homosexual friends popping up all over the place, and I honestly wouldn't be surprised if it's coming down to the lack of women out there that they can find.
Or not being able to find the right woman.
Yeah, precisely. It's becoming more and more difficult. I know for me it was... several years, I didn't exactly rush into anything, but the amount of women out there that just...
Didn't appeal,
had some sort of major issues in their life that they hadn't dealt with yet. It may be an issue of age, obviously being only 21, not exactly getting on in years yet, so it's... something that we can look at. It's not something that was really an issue for me at this stage.
Right, okay. Do you think, I know you do a bit of clubbing, and I know you go out to cruises with the car and you go to races. Do you think it's the places where you're trying to meet these girls? Is it the right place to meet them?
I had a steadfast rule of not dating anyone I met clubbing.
probably a good idea.
Basically, it's not the place to meet people. The extent of the conversation and being able to get to know someone is next to impossible in that kind of situation. And basically, people go out when they go out clubbing, if they are looking to go home with someone, it's certainly not as a long-term relationship. So, no, I've always avoided that. And in the car scene, it's a little bit hit and miss. Sometimes you can get women involved in it that are genuinely interested, but there are also quite a lot that have no interest except how expensive your car is. So they're probably not the two best places to try and find women.
That's probably a pretty sad indictment, isn't it, if they look at what sort of car you drive first. But that's been an age-old problem, I think you'll find. But I wonder, we read a lot in the newspaper about the aggression of some young women nowadays. Do you see much of that when you're out?
I see probably more women getting involved in altercations than I do men. They tend to be a little more minor, more just some hair pulling and shoving. Whereas when the guys get involved, it tends to be
A little bit more damaging,
but I've never seen a guy attack a woman while out clubbing, and it just tends to be over with fairly quickly. But that's about the extent of it. There is, I think, a marked increase in violence from women. It's quite scary. Almost every time I'm out, I see some sort of altercation between women.
And is there a worry about false allegations that might be made?
I think those issues more come around if someone's taken someone home, basically, which I was never particularly interested in, mainly because of those issues.
So you were always cautious about that?
Yes, I had a girl make that allegation against me when absolutely nothing happened. It wasn't in a clubbing environment. It was someone I thought was a friend. It didn't go anywhere.
Would you mind just elaborate? What allegation was that, sorry?
She'd broken up with her boyfriend, and I was, she was crying. I was just comforting her, saying, hey, it's okay.
Shoulder to cry on.
Yeah, basically. I put my hand just on her knee, and that was it. And she's then gone around telling people that I attempted to sleep with her, so...
I think it takes more than that, doesn't it, than a hand on the knee?
Yeah, that was my opinion. I only found out about it about 6 months after it occurred, after a friend had told me what she'd been saying to people.
So these issues that we're seeing nowadays are clearly having an effect on young men, aren't they? Would you say that young men now, in the past perhaps 3 years or 4 years, are becoming more cautious?
I think it's probably been a bit longer than that. I think it's not so much being cautious, it's more they're just not interested in getting involved in the drama at this stage.
They just switch off.
They tend to switch off and just be more interested in just a one-night fling, to put it simply.
A really, really, really casual affair.
Yeah, precisely. And by the time they get to a little older, towards their 30s, then they start... becoming more interested in settling down, but up until that stage it's pretty rare for people to get involved any younger than that.
What about you? I know you've got some older friends who are married and in a relationship. Do any of them have children yet?
Yeah, a few do. One of my friends who is just in a new relationship has a child to a former partner. There's actually quite a few that do. And
what does he think about his prospects of remaining in that child's life?
Well, it's actually her, but she's been quite understanding in both children seeing, in the child seeing both parents.
So he's got shared care, virtually?
Not quite shared care. Work doesn't quite allow for him to have shared care, but he still sees the child a substantial amount of time, and the child has a good relationship with the father. But on that note, the father's new partner, the child does not get along with, so...
So there are problems already there.
How
does he see that affecting his new relationship?
Well, I'm not too sure what he's done with it. I haven't been involved that deeply with it to really know what's going on, but it's just one of those issues that we seem to come across fairly regularly.
knowing what happens with families these days where there is a readiness to separate, and often this causes, you know, ongoing problems for many, many years, has that, do you think, had any effect on young blokes' attitude towards getting into permanent relationships with women?
Yeah, I think getting to the stage of a de facto relationship or into a marriage is quite off-putting to some people. I mean, they're at risk of losing property or cars or...
Cars being the all-important issue?
Well, no, it's a major financial investment for some people. So it comes down to you could definitely lose those things or at least a substantial portion of them.
And if you
if
have
things
children?
Go sour. Yep, if things go sour, then obviously... if you have children and things go sour, then you have the issue of child support, which I don't think any of them want to skirt. It's more just the issue that they're no longer with the mother and they're not seeing the child as much, and it's taking up a substantial portion of their income when they're barely seeing the child.
Without having the input into the child.
Yes, precisely.
Yeah. That's often a complaint that we hear from a lot of guys, that they don't have any say in how the money is spent when it comes to child support. But those are, it's interesting to hear you talk, because I don't think I don't think young people are asked often the questions of how they see the future. You know, is it really becoming so detrimental in the notion that things might not work out, that your family relationship might break down, and a lot of them do, unfortunately, that it is going to be so off-putting to people that they won't enter into a relationship, permanent relationship?
I think quite a lot of waiting. There are still people willing to enter into relationships. I think they're just a little more casual. Cautious, definitely. They're not looking to get married quite as young. It's a little bit of a difficult one to put your finger on, because every person is different. But I do think people are being more cautious with entering into relationships.
Look, thank you, Andrew. I think that's given us a good insight into what our younger generation think, and I think as parents we need to take all those considerations on board, that we need to be thinking about what sort of future we're handing over to our children. That's why we're involved, that's why our dedication to trying to keep fathers in their children's life has been so immense at this stage, because we consider, you know, if we don't, then we're handing over a pretty sad situation to our future parents of the next generation. Ian, I would like to ask people before we finish, I know the program's about to wind up, to seriously come on board with some of the initiatives that we're running at the moment, which is the postcards to politicians. They can do that by getting onto our website and just letting us know that they want to send some postcards to politicians to protest the shared parenting rollback. Also, the vote that we have running also from our website about what your voting intentions would be if the Labor Party do roll back the shared parenting. And on the interim basis, I have to tell you, it's coming out almost 100% against Labor. But we do need some more people to participate. So if anyone out there listening hasn't participated yet, please do so. Please go to our website, which is www.mensrights.com.au.
Well, thank you, Sue Price, for today's show. And the show will be available from dadsontheair.net. It should be available as a download sometime from this afternoon on. We'll be back next week. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We ask no more questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're dads.